Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. ISIS is notorious for its use of social media, routinely employing Facebook and Twitter to tout its propaganda. The hacktivist group Anonymous, a group of outlaws in its own right, according to some, is looking to put a cyber plug in the so-called Islamic State. Joining us now is director of the Institute of Homeland Security and Cybercrime School of Criminology, Criminal Justice and Strategic Studies at Tarleton State University in Texas, Christopher Copeland. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
First, sort of summarize how ISIS has used social media to their advantage and what sites and services they use the most.
Well, right out of the gate, they use Twitter the most. And they use Twitter to propagate the message of ISIS, as well as videos, photos, anything that they can do to recruit and promote what they consider their call to action.
And their primary target being young males?
Actually, anyone.
Okay.
It does not have to be young males. They will take anybody they can take.
And you write, for ISIS, social media is a marketing plan. What do you mean by that? I mean, how sophisticated is it?
Well, I would love to take credit for that, but that's actually Farwell's work.
Okay.
I simply gave credit where it was due. It is a marketing plan. By terms of that, what we mean is that ISIS will consistently send out the same message to as many followers or as many possible recruits as possible using social media. It is a branding strategy. They do their very best to produce high quality videos, high quality photos, high quality music to attract it as you would any sort of public relations campaign.
And do we know anything about who inside ISIS is responsible for this? Anyone in particular?
Not in particularly.
Mm-hmm.
There have been. This is software and hardware that you can get freely.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody with any sort of knowledge on how to use even an iMac could produce these videos.
Western nations are having a hard time dealing with this social media strategy of ISIS's. Why do you think that is? What makes it such a difficult task? We're going to get to how Anonymous is coping, is facing it. Why is it such a big deal for Western nations?
It's a big deal for Western nations primarily because of the rule of law. I'll use the United States as an example for this. In the United States, for us to take any sort of legal action against a social media site like Twitter or Facebook, you must show that a crime has been committed. It's fine for Facebook or Twitter or any social media service to act on its own terms of service. For
mm-hmm.
instance, if you have violated some terms of service, they can cancel the account anyway. But for prosecution's sake, you have to have a warrant in the United States. You have to have probable cause. There is due process. So in one way, we're bound by the very laws that we're trying to uphold.
The hacktivist group Anonymous has publicly, quote unquote, declared war on ISIS in the wake of the Paris attacks. What have they been doing up to that point? Because it's certainly not the beginning of their efforts against ISIS.
No, it's certainly not the beginnings. The beginnings actually came right after Charlie Hebdo.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't the first time ISIS has been taken on by Anonymous, and it probably will not be the last. This is the first time I think we've seen it done on such a scale. In the past, what they've done is they've targeted certain websites, they've targeted certain email accounts. You know, in this regard, they're targeting what they think ISIS uses the most, which would be Twitter.
And what are they doing?
They're actually following the law. From the first stage of this, from what I've been able to tell, is that they're simply reporting sites that violate Twitter's terms of service. And in reporting these sites, Twitter takes those sites down.
Okay, so Twitter is doing that. Why isn't Twitter just doing it on their own?
Twitter is not self-policing for the most part. It relies
mm-hmm.
upon its user base to report.
So how many sites have they been able to take down now? Do we know?
Actual numbers will vary.
Mm-hmm.
depending on who is reporting from anonymous, the number is quite rangeful. It's between 28,000 and 98,000 Twitter accounts.
Whoa. That's a lot.
It's a lot of accounts, but it also doesn't take very long to create an account. Accounts are often abandoned. Mm-hmm. So, you know, instead of closing an account down, I might just leave that account and move on and make another one. They're called dead drop accounts, or you can call them throwaway accounts.
So is this all they're doing?
Right now. There has been chatter on various websites that Anonymous uses, and I don't necessarily want to stay that out on the air because there may be active law enforcement operations on those sites.
Mm-hmm.
That have released sort of a strategy. They are looking for the best bang for their buck in terms of taking down the ability to create these accounts, the ability to create mass media, host the media accounts. You know, just because you've created the video doesn't mean it'll stay up on YouTube very long. They have to link it from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they're targeting those websites as well.
I mentioned, you know, the referral to them as, you know, they're lawbreakers themselves, Anonymous.
Yes. So
how does that change this dynamic or affect it?
It changes it only in the sense that as long as they are not breaking the law here, doing what they're doing, it doesn't mean they won't break the law some other time or haven't broken the law in the past. You know, there's several statutes in the United States and Western countries for the most part that say breaking into an account, breaking into a service or accessing a service without permission is illegal, usually at the federal level. And certainly in the United States, it's illegal both at the federal level and at the state level and in almost all states, with some varying degrees on, you know, how it's classified as a crime. So, you know, just in the aspect of being a hacktivist isn't illegal. Being a hacktivist and then doing something with that can be illegal.
What does all of this tell you about who Anonymous is?
Well, Anonymous certainly has changed over the years. Originally, they did not have a social calling. And we've seen this sort of morph into a social justice, true on the word, hacktivism. Stance. This has not been their original intent. Their original intent really was just sort of chaos, mayhem, and laughing. It was all for jokes and it was all for pranks. But as the world sort of changed its attitude towards terrorism and has changed its attitude towards social injustice, so too has groups like Anonymous. They've changed to meet a calling.
And how does an organization the likes of the United States government juggle their different relationships with Anonymous?
Not sure that they have multiple relationships with Anonymous in this case. I think the relationship between law enforcement agencies in the United States mm-hmm. and Anonymous is still confrontational.
Okay.
As long as members of Anonymous, and that can be anyone, are willing to break the law, law enforcement will prosecute them.
Regardless.
It's still a crime.
And is what they're doing to ISIS right now typical of what they do in their other operations?
Typical, yes. On the scale, and I say that only in the methodology aspect, mm-hmm. in terms of how they're going about doing what they're doing, it is very typical. In terms of the scale to which they're doing it, it's been a while since we've seen something this large.
Anonymous is a leaderless organization. How do they make it work then? How do they coordinate?
So it's leaderless as if no one runs the entire organization. But you can consider Anonymous more like small cells. There may be one small group over, I'll just say, you know, I'm from Texas, so I'll use it as a representative. There may be one small group out of Texas. There may be a small group out of Washington or, you know, out of British Columbia. And these small groups may have a quote-unquote leader, but they act independently, coordinating through online message boards and internet chat to maximize their efforts. No one group is in charge of Anonymous.
Tell us, I mean, the hashtag OPISIS, Op ISIS.
Op ISIS.
Yeah, that. What does that mean?
It really is just nothing more than another branding tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's to say, you know, what I'm doing right now, I'm doing in on this marketing line. So the hashtag OpISIS, O-P-I-S-I-S, is really nothing more than I did this, or I'm calling to action this tweet or this Facebook post. It has to do with OpISIS, the operation against ISIS. It really is nothing more than to help something trend.
Now, you said that the U.S. will prosecute, you know, law enforcement will prosecute when Anonymous does something illegal, as they have tried to do in the past. So far, they're not necessarily doing anything illegal.
So far,
right.
In terms of what's
that
been
we know
released
of.
Publicly that
yeah.
we know of,
mm-hmm.
All they're doing right now is reporting Twitter and Facebook pages to their appropriate terms of service violations, which is completely legal.
Right. And law enforcement can pick and choose, and they do all the time, particularly when it comes to drug laws in the United States, for instance, what they're going to push and what they're going to prosecute. Is there any sense about that, that this may not be a top priority if ISIS is, I mean, if Anonymous is doing damage to ISIS?
Well, it can be a top priority, and I'm certainly not a drug law expert, but it can be a top priority in terms of what law enforcement is doing currently to assess information. As an example, let's say that I have a Twitter account and I am actively propagating a terrorist agenda. Law enforcement may be monitoring that account.
Mm-hmm.
It may be monitoring it for intelligence gathering.
Mm-hmm.
It may be communicating with me through that, via private message or instant message regarding that account in a method to obtain information about current ongoing intelligence gathering. And Anonymous comes along and gets that account shut down. Well, then they've cut out a legitimate purpose of intelligence gathering. So it can be detrimental to law enforcement. So they do have to, it can affect what law enforcement is doing.
And in the final analysis, does ISIS even care? What, in the grand scheme of things, does this really do much to weaken ISIS?
Well, they came out with a public statement claiming that Anonymous were idiots.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so in the grand scheme of things, it would appear that ISIS does not care. In the smaller scheme of things, and when you look under that sheath, what you're finding is, well, if you don't care, why are you posting out tips and tricks for your constituency, mm-hmm. sort of, on how to protect themselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so on the one hand, ISIS comes out and says, you know, they're idiots. We don't care. It doesn't affect us any. But then here are 10 ways that you can protect yourselves. You know, all the brethren should protect themselves using these 10 methods. So it tells me they do care. They care enough that they see at least somewhat of a threat to protect themselves.
And what are some of the, I mean, what are the tactics to protect themselves from what Anonymous might be doing?
Well, believe it or not, it's the same tactics that you and I can take to protect ourselves from online hackers, changing passwords, not communicating with people that you're unfamiliar with, making sure that you've updated your security patches and vulnerabilities, all the standard things, run encryption, you know, don't communicate without using some form of encryption,
mm-hmm.
All the standard things that even the Justice Department tells United States citizens to follow.
Okay. Well, Christopher Copeland, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I guess this story's not going away anytime soon.
Probably not. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. That's Christopher Copeland. He's director of the Institute of Homeland Security and Cybercrime School of Criminology, Criminal Justice, and Strategic Studies at Tarleton State University in Texas. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From unemployed coal miners to computer coders, those are two very different jobs with very different skill sets. But one former coal miner is looking to change that by breaking the stereotypes of Appalachians and putting them to work in the tech industry. Lauren Smiley, a reporter for Back Channel on Medium.com, wrote about this recently. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. For now, she joins us on the show. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann.
You profile former coal miner Rusty Justice and his problem with former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Tell us about the story and how it fits in with all of this.
So Rusty Justice, and that is his real name, he has owned a land moving company all his life there in Pikeville, Kentucky, there in Appalachia. And he had been looking for the last couple years during this coal downturn for an alternative industry that would somehow match the sort of high wages that coal miners had gotten. The stat they usually say is about $60,000 to $80,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And so him and his business partner had looked at wind farms, they had looked at fish farms and just farming, and had been looking for some sort of replacement job or industry they could get going in what had really been a one-source economy. And they went to a tech incubator up in Lexington to talk with the founder there, who said that actually, yes, a junior developer in Kentucky can make about $60,000 to $80,000 a year. And their ears perked up from that and just started discussing, should we start a tech company in Eastern Kentucky? Of course, it really hadn't been done before. Mm-hmm. But he's a very idealistic guy and pragmatic guy. And said, okay, let's go for it. And so started this startup called BitSource that is now training 10 former coal miners who had been out of jobs, had been laid off from the industry into coders. And so with Michael Bloomberg, he had said a year ago at an energy summit in New York City, he had been talking about, you know, the masses of coal miners that are out of a job. And, of course, Mike Bloomberg has given tens of millions of dollars to the Beyond Coal campaign that is trying to like systematically close down coal-fired power plants across the country and mm-hmm. successfully doing so. And he said, well, we need to have compassion for these miners that are getting out of work because of this. And it's not like you're going to turn a coal miner into a coder. And so Rusty saw this as sort of a challenge to his plan was already in the works at that point. Mm-hmm. And he saw it as sort of a challenge to overturn the stereotypes that have sort of been directed at Appalachia and miners for years.
But just given the difference in the, you know, the skill set, as I mentioned earlier, did that make Rusty stop and think before he pursued this goal of transitioning industries?
No, actually, they were very much of the mindset that this was actually going to be somewhat within the skill set of miners. Because, like, I was as ignorant as the next person about mining before I went there to do mm-hmm. reporting. But as I learned, this is like it turned into a very technical industry. It's not like they're using pickaxes anymore. So mm-hmm. there's actually a lot of engineers, drafters, machine operators that are working there on these sites to, you know, get coal out of a mountain, you know, every day. Mm-hmm. And so they were already quite technical workers. And they put out a call for miners who'd want to learn to be a computer programmer. And he was hoping for just like 50 applications, and he ended up getting 900 applications of out-of-work coal miners who were interested. Yeah. And so they whittled it down to about 60 candidates, and then they gave them an assessment. And since, you know, they can't be assessing for, you know, whether you can code or not, because nobody can, they had to assess for sort of the mindset and just the mindset that a coder would have to have. Like, are you a logical thinker? Are you a technical thinker? Or how are you at math? And then also just the ability to sit and have an office job and sit in front of a computer 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And from that, he whittled it down to these 10 that they're now 8 months into the job.
You know, I was playing on code.org. It's a site for children, which is about all I can do when it comes to coding. But they start out with Minecraft, ironically.
Ah, okay. Well, I think in this one, they started out with HTML.
Okay.
week, and they all had to make a HTML site or web page the first week. And some made a tribute to, like, University of Kentucky basketball. I think one guy made a tribute to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
It's going to be a different sort of ilk, though, right?
Well, from what they found, the skills have, like, transferred. I mean, they've studied like crazy. They now have added all these coding languages into their vocabulary. Mm-hmm. They kind of open source some curriculum off the web, and then they watched a lot of instructional videos off lynda.com, and then read the Pragmatic Programmer. A lot of them ordered extra books off of Amazon to study, by themselves at night to cram more. And they are now, like, closing contracts of actual, websites. They're developing their first app now, and it seems to be working.
You wrote in your article that outsiders have never gotten Appalachia. And why is this significant to this story?
Yeah, well, what I found when I went there is that at first people are very wary of, like, outsider reporters coming in to do stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, like, everyone, I found this is almost universal. People could, like, name specific stories in specific publications or on news, on broadcast news, had just kind of come in for what I call in the story their poverty porn, mm-hmm. where they come in and, write about how poor and downtrodden and
hard scrabble and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're so sick of being painted in that way. And like I said in the story, it's not like that stuff doesn't exist. It does, but they just are annoyed that that's the only thing that ever gets covered out of their corner of the United States. And nobody focuses on anything else. And so I think to a degree, I was sort of treated with skepticism that that was what I was there to do as well, mm-hmm. Coming in from California to do this story. But once I got past this, I found that they were incredibly welcoming. Rusty ended up taking me on a big tour of the coal field,
mm-hmm.
in that area, of just like one really closed mine after another. It was really interesting to see. For him, it's rather heartbreaking because he's worked around that industry all his life. But yeah, I think there's just a general sense that, that the country doesn't really get them and only wants to sort of, taunt them, I guess.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, we're talking about taking unemployed coal miners and turning them into computer coders. My guest is Lauren Smiley. She's a staff reporter at Medium. We'll have her, Medium.com, I should say, and we'll have her article on our website. I'll link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Lauren Smiley, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Where did they get the money? I mean, how did they fund this startup training program?
Yeah, so since the coal industry has sort of crashed in such a dramatic way in the last couple of years, there have been millions of dollars poured in from the federal government through the Department of Labor to this area in recent years in an attempt to sort of diversify the economy and get people other jobs, retrain for other jobs right away. And so when they started BitSource, they had this deal that the very first 22 weeks of the actual training segment of the job, because it was a job. It wasn't they go in and do training. They were hired to learn to code. So mm-hmm. it was a job. And the first 22 weeks were all paid for from this federal money coming through sort of an economic development agency there in Eastern Kentucky. And then after those 22 weeks, now BitSource is putting up $3 to every $1 of federal money during this time that they're kind of getting ramped up to full proficiency at building the website. And that was very important to Rusty as well, that this isn't just a sort of school where they learn to code and mm-hmm. then they have to go off. And because this is what has happened for years, anyone from this area of the country that wants to work in tech had to like move away to Lexington or to some, you know, regional city there to get a job. And they want to start an actual native Pikeville, Kentucky tech scene right there on the ground where people don't have to move, that it could be a replacement industry for some folks.
Randy in Columbus, you're on the air with Lauren Smiley. Hi, Randy.
Oh, hi, Ann. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was curious to know where all these jobs are going to be in Appalachia. I mean, I deal with a lot of workers in West Virginia and Appalachian, Ohio. There are no services in the region almost across the board. I'm somewhat skeptical that the state that just elected a crazy conservative governor is going to fund some burgeoning tech industry in western Kentucky.
And are you talking about services? You mean internet, high-speed internet connection, that kind of thing?
No, I'm talking about all services.
Okay, all right. Lauren?
From the very basic. They don't have medical care.
Yeah, well, for now, the money that they're using is federal funds. It's not state funds, for the most part, from what I was hearing. And so they are getting some federal help. And they are actually a first city or a first area chosen to, in the White House's tech hire program, which is working across the United States to create a way into tech jobs for people who are not going to get a four-year computer science degree at a university. So just that coding camps or coding classes for workers to sort of upskill into digital jobs. And Eastern Kentucky was actually the first rural area that was chosen among the first, I believe, 30 sites in the United States. The rest were all like urban areas. And so for the most part, the support at this point is federal, and then they have regional development agencies that are working on this as well.
What about the high-speed internet infrastructure in Appalachia? It's supposed to be, well, it's supposed to stink.
Well, so I heard that outside of the actual towns there, like the bigger towns, Pikeville or Prestonsburg,
right,
a lot of people are still on dial-up. But this is going to change. There's actually, since this has been an area of the country that's been lagging in, you know, their internet connection, I think starting late this year, early next year, they're actually having a universal rollout of dark fiber across that entire area, once again, federally funded. And I know that the congressman there from that area, Hal Rogers, is already trying to tout it as Silicon Holler.
Oh, jeez. So much for stereotypes, right? But and so, all right, that's fine. It's going to be extremely expensive, which is why it hasn't been done thus far, right? It could take
a
lot of time.
I mean, yeah, they're just getting going. And there was never any, like, pretending to the other, you know, to the contrary either. I mean, they're very clear that, yes, we're just beginning this. We have to start somewhere. We started with a group of 10 coders, and there's a whole plan here. They would like to start a second class in the new year of coders to learn. And then they also would like to, little by little, create a sort of a tech ecosystem there in Pikeville. They have this whole Coca-Cola bottling plant that Rusty has bought, and it's just empty right now for the most part, and they want to fill this up with a business incubator there for other tech entrepreneurs or other business endeavors. They want to make a maker space there for people interested in doing, like, sort of craftsmen or hardware, and they're hoping this is just the beginning of something much larger, and they've actually created a name for this endeavor called hashtag Appalachia. And they have a website in which they're trying to start this movement.
What have been the challenges there?
I think they were saying that, you know, it's not easy to leave coal mining and become a coder overnight. I mean, there was obviously a very steep, and there is a very steep learning curve here of transferring the skills. Because I should mention, it's not like they chose all, like, 22-year-old miners either. They range in age from like mid-20s to mid-50s.
Mm-hmm.
There was an older guy there who was actually in his free time, I believe a Baptist preacher, that he had become one in his time on unemployment.
Oh, okay.
After he was laid off. And so, yeah, it's not like they're all spring chickens either, but they've been on this learning curve. And one thing that the team leader there had told me is that along with just the coding skills themselves, he had to sort of instill a comfort with discomfort. And, you know, a lot of the things we say in Silicon Valley, like fail fast and iterate or fail forward, these are not kind of the ways that, you know, the coal mining industry works. There's not this emphasis on, like, constructive failure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said one thing he had to instill in the miners is that, you know, nothing's going to go terribly wrong if you get a line of code wrong, and that to be open to making mistakes. And that discomfort is a desired state, is what you would say to them. And so it's been a change in mentality as well.
And they've responded. How are they doing? I mean, he's obviously able to buy this abandoned Coca-Cola plant. So he's not, you know, he must be doing okay so far. But what's the next step?
Yeah, well, he has, you know, of course, like most in that area, he's made his money over the years off of the mining industry. He has a land moving company that did sort of the reclaiming of surface mines, you know, the people that come in and
this
sort
is
of
the
like,
strip mining stuff that they
right,
do. Yeah.
Right. But like plants, you know, moving some of the soil back into place, planting, you know, seed on top of the mountain, that sort of thing. He'd done land moving jobs around the mining industry. And so, yeah, from here on out, I mean, that had been 70% of his company's work was, you know, coal mining related. So he himself is looking for a new way to make money as well. And that's why there's this emphasis that this is not a charity. This is not a coding school, but he wants a profitable business that's actually closing contracts.
Is he getting business?
Yeah, so far they've done a few sites for the regional, sort of regional, mostly Eastern Kentucky-based businesses right now, or like government entities that wanted sort of a makeover on their website. So they've been doing websites so far. And I believe when I was there, they were trying to create their first app. That was Rusty's idea as well.
Okay. Well, are you going to stay in touch with them?
Oh, totally. We've been in contact. They've been, I think, completely delighted and a bit overwhelmed by the attention that this story has gotten and the Twitter attention. And I think the Department of Labor Secretary Thomas Perez actually tweeted this out yesterday.
Well, we have plenty of Appalachia counties in Ohio. Thanks to you, Lauren Smiley, for talking with us about it today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
That's Lauren Smiley, a staff reporter for Medium.com. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The time for rampant gift giving is almost here, and tech gifts remain very popular, even for young children. Our regular guest, Russell Holly of Android Central, has been putting together a special gift guide for Tech Tuesdays. We begin the series today with ideas for children. Welcome back, Russell.
Hello, thank you.
So we have a picture of the Little Bits electronics base kit on the cover of our website today. First of all, what is Little Bits?
So it's a starter kit, basically, for kids to get into more advanced kind of electronics creation. So they think about a thing that they would like, maybe an alarm that goes off when their door opens, you know, if they've got a sibling that, you know, busts in their room. And the Little Bits kit gives them the sensors and the hardware to kind of snap together the creation that would do that.
And the idea is that they can use it to create all different kinds of things, or is the starter kit something? Okay.
The starter kit has well over 100 different applications that you can go through, and there are tons of accessory packs that can be added to it. Some of them are, you know, not particularly expensive, but some of them are themed for like space exploration or Very specific kind of craft designs, and those can get a little expensive depending on what is inside the kit.
What kind of components are in the starter kit?
The starter kit has a couple of basic things. It has some basic sensors for sound and for motion, as well as a speaker, a light that'll blink, and then the ability to listen for commands from a phone or a computer.
Now, you have kids. Why do you think this makes a good gift for kids?
It is a fantastic way to explore creativity. And this is not a new idea. The idea that, kids can have these kind of basic kits to build their own circuit boards to do things have been around for longer than I've been alive.
Well, yeah, it goes back to the Erector set. And
exactly.
Yeah.
But what makes Little Bits kid-friendly is that everything kind of magnetically snaps together, all these little boards that do the different things, they snap together, and it's very, very easy, so that the kids only have to think about the concepts that they want to assemble instead of worrying about, soldering or anything like that. This is really just the kind of higher level, ideas that come together to form these creations that they've made.
So they
and that's one of the things that I appreciate about it.
And they don't need special tools, I imagine.
No, this is all something that can be done right from the kitchen table, with no power or anything like that. When you do decide to turn it on, it can be as simple as a 9-volt battery.
And where do you get these? Is this something online, or do you recommend where people can go and look at them?
So this is entirely online for some of the kits, but the starter kit can be found in Barnes & Noble. I think Walmart carries them now. Radio Shack, if you still have one in your area, will have them as well. So there are a bunch of different places where you can see the starter kit in stores, and it's $89 for the starter kit. But if you want to look into some of the more advanced kits, your best bet is to check out Amazon.
Okay. And I remember getting something like this for our kid many years ago. It was like a little robotics kit where you could build little robots. He
right.
didn't really get into it until we banned him from electronics for a week, and then he finally got into it and whipped him up in a few days, all of them. But
well, I think the interesting thing about the way that Little Bits is designed is it instead of starting off with a set of instructions that you read out of a book, you start by asking the question, what is it you want that you don't currently have, in your room or in your house, And it's something simple that a kid goes, man, it'd be really neat if I had this. And these are the tools to do that.
Cool. So it kind of goes to a different level of creativity.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. And you said $89 for that starter kit.
Mm-hmm.
And they can take it apart and put it together in lots of different ways.
It's a bunch of different magnets, basically, with boards attached to the top. And they all snap together. And it's a single power source that'll power an entire board when it's all assembled. It's very, very easy to use.
The Acer Chromebook, you also wanted to talk about that. What makes a Chromebook different than a regular laptop or even something like Microsoft Surface Pro when it comes to kids?
So the Chromebook is, as far as the user is concerned, just the web browser. It's just Chrome, and its software updates are entirely done automatically. There's no, have to update every application. It all happens in the background. The user doesn't have to really mess with anything. They just, accomplish the task they want to accomplish and get off. And what makes the hardware partners that have worked with Google to make Chromebooks work is usually they're incredibly low price. This one in particular is $150, and it is an amazing starter computer for kids who are just doing research online or, typing up reports for school or even basic kind of web browsing habits that are being taught by parents. It's a really great way to kind of, get them started on that journey at home.
What about actual performance? Is this something they're going to start working on and go, well, this isn't as great as dad's computer. I want to go back and goof around with that.
So you're not going to be playing the high-end video games. My daughter's not going to sit at this and then sit at my desktop computer and think that these are the same experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to surfing the web, watching videos on YouTube, participating in, online games that are, web-based online games, it's the same experience. The performance, unless you are the kind of person that have 15 web browser tabs open to do stuff, you're usually not going to notice a difference in performance.
And this is a starter computer. This is for little kids?
It's really for anybody, but it's small enough that a child could sit with it on their lap and be comfortable using it.
Mm-hmm. How young do you think, what would you say, assuming you can afford $150?
Really, I think, you know, this age is one of those things that's really kind of subjective for each parent. But I would say, you know, starting at like age 8 or age 10, you know, this is something that, you know, if your child is responsible enough to handle something like this, then this is a good way to go.
Do kids at that age care what color it is?
Yes.
Okay.
At least mine did.
How big of a deal is that?
You know, it's one of those things that if you give them the choice, they will obviously make a choice. But if one isn't there, or there is the option to maybe put stickers on it or something like that, then it's probably not a big deal.
I was thinking the sticker route myself.
Yep.
Because it's white, right?
Yes. They do have slate gray versions, I think. But the white is what you'll find most commonly in like Best Buy and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, let's see, the Disney Infinity 3.0 Edition Starter Pack Xbox 360.
So this is actually available for all of the game consoles that are out right now. Xbox 360, Xbox One, PlayStation 3 and 4, and even there's even a version for Apple TV, which I thought was really cool. But it's a collectible game that is really, really popular with so many kids right now because it takes all of their favorite Disney characters and puts them in this world where they can control them and play with them and do things. And it has grown really phenomenally over the last couple of years to include the stuff from Marvel's Avengers and most recently in the 3.0 release from the Star Wars universe. So there's a ton of these collectible figurines, and they take these figurines and they put them on this pedestal that comes with the game. And it takes that physical character and puts them in the game for the child to play with.
You've talked about this before. You just love this.
I'm a big fan because, like, every time I sit it down, and not just my kids, any kid that I sit this thing down to, because it creates a really personal connection between the toy, and so they end up taking really good care of it.
Hmm.
You know, because when you do things in the game, instead of saving the information to the game, you're actually saving it to the physical character.
Oh.
So you tell the child that, you know, you have to be careful with this thing because this is where all of your information is, the costume that they're wearing and, you know, the accessories that they have, you know, they're all baked into that thing. And so that toy basically, you know, has to, you know, stay taken care of in order to get that same effect. And so, you know, it's something that my kids' Disney Infinity collection is probably better cared for than any of the other toys I've ever bought them.
Really? Interesting. And so tell me about the figurines. What do they do differently from each other?
Really, it's the characters, you know, so you've got all the Disney princesses and they look like all the Disney princesses when you buy them. It's the Star Wars characters and the, you know, Marvel's Avengers, all of the Marvel universe, you know, including the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff. And, you know, just really, really far out. Disney has thrown a ton of money at this project and created so many of these figurines that collecting them all would be just impossible. And, you know, so your child can pick the ones that they are most familiar with. And, you know, when a game comes out or when a new movie comes out, there's usually figurines that go right along with it. The most recent example being the Inside Out.
Oh, yeah, right.
So there's just a ton of different options available there for kids to choose, you know, the things that they care about and bring them into this game to play together.
Inside Out's a really different kind of a movie. I loved it. Tell me a little bit about one of the games or how they might use this for a movie like Inside Out.
So for Inside Out, they had a couple of different levels where you could run around and complete time puzzles. Like for Inside Out, it was chasing around Sadness to make sure that the bulbs were all the right color before time ran out. And, you know, so there are a couple of games that are themed directly towards the movie, but then you can bring them into the larger world that you've created to play with these other characters. So you end up running around in a world where Joy is hanging out with Captain Jack Sparrow, or you know, the Star Wars figurines are, you know, hanging out with the Avengers and stuff. So it all comes together into this thing that they call the Toy Box, which is this kind of Minecraft-like world that the child has created for these characters to play in.
The idea, visions of Joy hanging out with with Captain Jack Sparrow is kind of mind-boggling right now. But and how much do the figurines cost?
They vary. You can get them in packs that are usually around $30. That has usually two figurines and a level you know, a game or something that can be added to the setup in some way, or the individual characters, I think, are 15, where you can get the ones that you want. And then the core game itself varies between $40 and $60, depending on what console you're buying it for.
Yeah, so is there a better console than others, or are they all pretty much equal when it comes to this?
They're all really equal when it comes to this. You know, if it's really whatever the console is that your kids are more comfortable with.
Okay. Interesting. Disney Infinity 3.0 Edition Starter Pack. It's the third version of the game. Is it compatible with the first two iterations?
The figurines move over with no problem.
Okay.
If you have built a world in one of the other versions, you can move it over to this newer one. So yeah, it's just about as backwards compatible as you get. They've paid a lot of attention to that particular aspect.
And did you tell me the add-on packs cost about $30?
Some of them are $30. They vary in price depending on how many figurines are in there and what it is that they have.
What about the starter pack?
The starter pack, I think, is $69 for the Xbox One.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You wanted to talk about Code.org, so in order to prepare for this interview, I went on Code.org and had a really hard time ripping myself away from it.
It's
a website that teaches kids computer skills and also older people. It was pretty cool. Why is it important?
This is a website that has come together. The Code.org people have reached out to a ton of different groups. To ask their help for animations and designs and stuff to create these really fun kind of game-like structures that teach the fundamentals of programming. They have this thing they call it the Hour of Code, and they have it themed in just dozens of different ways. The one that they're currently trumpeting on the website is Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your Minecraft figurine, and they have to go through these levels to do things that are all very Minecraft-themed. But in order to accomplish the challenges that are in this little mini game that have been created, you have to, you have to be able to demonstrate the ability to create, a script basically for your character to run through and do. And as you go through this hour of code, it becomes more complex. You start learning more about the different ways that you have to assemble these instructions. And when you reach the end of that hour, you've completed, between 10 and 15 of these kind of mini level instructions, and you've got a pretty reasonable understanding of the kind of building blocks for programming.
I had done something like this, I don't know, maybe a year ago or so, and was so thrilled that I could just jump onto this. And I actually did learn. I understand more and more every time I do it. It'll probably be another year, but whatever. What all does the website offer, and what's the price tag?
So it's free. The Hour of Code is free, and you can set up whatever theme you want. If you have a child who is really into Minecraft or Frozen or Star Wars, they have these Hour of Code sessions for each of these, and it really helps a child sit down and focus, or an adult sit down and focus, depending on on what happens. And then you can push beyond that Hour of Code. You can create an account, which is also free, and they just have dozens more of these modules that increase in complexity and kind of teach these, really basic, building blocks for creating shapes and interacting with these shapes. And by the end of, say, a week of doing this, you're probably ready to move on to, something that actually teaches a discrete programming language.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking about it. That's code.org. We'll put a link to it. Well, it's code.org, but we'll put a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you forget that, code.org. In the meantime, Russell Holley, have a great holiday, and thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's a contributing editor for Android Central, a regular on from the very beginning on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Happy Thanksgiving to all, and to all a good day. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.